Blog Talk Radio.
Dallas, Texas, on Thursday, August 28th, day number 229 of 2014. Tonight we're going to continue our series of programs about World War I. This is actually the fourth chapter that we've done, or the fourth volume that we've done, and we'll be joined in a minute here by our friend Barry Jacobson, who's going to be telling us a lot tonight about the United States and Russia. Those are going to be two of our major segments tonight on how the United States entered the war, and of course, what was happening in Russia 1917, the Bolshevik Revolution. So a lot of interesting stuff tonight with Barry to get into. You know, if you're the kind of person who likes to listen to books, audio books, we're going to recommend that you go to the show information, and click on audible.com. Click on that. It'll take you to their website, and I think you're going to see an amazing inventory of audio books. And if you get one, listen, you're going to make my day if you get one, because they've been kind enough to sponsor us through Blog Talk Radio. So click on that link and find yourself an audiobook and make my evening here in Dallas, Texas. I wanted to do a quick on this day in history. This has nothing to do with World War I, more to do with the Catholic Church. So let me just do a quick on this day in history. On this day in 1774, so that's a long time ago, that was 2 years before the Declaration of Independence, a lady by the name of Elizabeth Ann Bailey was born in New York City, and she, of course, went on to become the first saint from the United States, an amazing woman with a great career, particularly in education. She did a great thing in Maryland, finding, establishing schools, creating schools for the poor, just an absolutely amazing life. And we remember today Elizabeth Ann Bailey, who was born on this day in 1774. I believe her name eventually became Elizabeth Seton. I think that was the name that she used when she became a saint. So anyway, a little Catholic history there for our Catholic friends. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with Barry right after this. Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. We're going to say hello here in a minute to Barry Jacobson. The light wouldn't go on, and I was getting a little panicky, but the light is on. Barry's on. How are you, Barry?
I am good, and I'm not panicked.
Well, good.
I'm calm and ready to discuss the war with you.
You're cool, calm, and collected. That's your,
as always.
That's your design. So I am, too, most of the time, but I kept pushing the button, and I didn't see you coming on, and I said, oh, my God, we've lost the Internet, because that's what happens when we lose the Internet. The lights don't go on. But anyway, everything's fine. Everything is under control, and everything is just operating great. How are you today?
I am well. It's been a hot and kind of hot and sultry day here in Temecula. It's the dog days of summer, as they say, but it beats wintertime in most parts of the country, so I'm happy.
Well, it beats summertime in some parts of the country, too, when it's 100 degrees here. So we could use a little bit of your San Diego temperature over here, not just now, but pretty much year-round. You guys must have the perfect temperature over there. Now, we're going to get into a couple of big segments tonight on the United States and Russia, but you have an On This Day in History that you want to tell us about. So tell me about it.
Well, it's actually a couple days old, but it's on the 26th of August, we celebrate or bemoan, depending on your nationality, the anniversary of the Battle of Manzikert, which I write about in my blog, Deadliest Blogger. It was called The Terrible Day in Byzantine History. And without getting too deeply in the weeds, it was probably the battle that triggered the Crusades. It was a battle in which the Byzantine or Roman Empire of the Middle Ages, you see, Rome didn't actually fall as we usually think of in 476. It only fell in the West. In the East, it continued for another 1,000 years. And we often call that the Byzantine Empire. And its capital, instead of Rome, was New Rome, which was modern-day Istanbul or Constantinople. And in 1072, the Grand Army of the Roman Empire was destroyed by the Turks. And the Turks subsequently took over the area that's now known as Turkey. And Turkey was, its roots are traced to the Battle of Manzikert.
And, of course, Turkey has also a connection to World War I, doesn't it?
In fact, it does. It was one of the central powers, and we're going to be talking tonight about the campaign in Palestine by General Allenby, including the famous charge of the Australian light horsemen at the Battle of Beersheba.
You know, Barry, I thought I would share with you this little message that we got from Leslie, or I got this message from Leslie earlier today. I just happened to see it right now. It says, compare and contrast today's chaos with the situation during World War I. And then here's the killer line from Leslie. Only wish I were living in downtown Abbey and wearing that era style of clothing. So, you know, this is, we always, you know, we always get a fun statement from Leslie. So, Leslie, that was a good one. Thank you for submitting that. That was absolutely great.
And in answer to kind of her question, I actually would think that the comparison is actually in some ways closer to what was happening in the 1930s, in that you have some aggressors that are going unchallenged.
Right.
For instance, Putin today, you know, tanks are now crossing the Ukrainian border. And Germany and Russia are in discussion over the fate of Ukraine. And they're really talking about an effective partition of Ukraine.
Right.
And where have we heard that before? Where, you know, the Allied powers essentially in Germany during the 1930s partitioned first Czechoslovakia, and then later Hitler and Russia partitioned Poland.
Right, and
we're
that kind
the same thing happen again.
That's right, and that kind of brings me into a what we saw this afternoon. President Obama, I guess, had a press conference. I didn't see it, but I saw bits and pieces of it. And I saw some of the commentary of the press conference, and he shows up at a press conference. Why he does this, I don't know. I mean, if you don't have a strategy, why even have a press conference? Why not just say, well, the president is not, you know, he's not going to do something today? I mean, but you don't call a press conference so that when people ask you, what's our strategy, you say, well, we don't have one. I mean, that's just embarrassing. You don't do that. You don't do that at any level. Of authority, whether it's the chairman of a company or the plant manager, or obviously not the president of the United States. But it really makes you wonder what is in this guy's state of mind must be. I don't know. I think we've got to start thinking about that seriously, Barry. I'm not trying to do psychobabble here, but my goodness, I mean, you would think the president of the United States would be a little bit more on top of the job.
Well, he hasn't been on top of the job, and he hasn't been really up to the job, except for the very narrow aspect of partisan politics, of which he's very good at. But as far as being the leader of the free world, I think he finally admitted, honestly today, something we've all suspected, and that was that he doesn't have a strategy really for anything. He kind of reacts to events. He doesn't have a strategy that's proactive. Now, if I was president of the United States, I went into a briefing, and before the briefing, I turned to my generals or my chief of staff, my national security advisor. You know, there's various people that are supposed to be on top of this stuff, and I said, "What is our plan for, you know, X, Y, or Z?" And they told me what he said today. Well, sir, we don't have one. We don't have a plan. The president should fire that person. And yet we can't fire the president. And certainly his people can't be blamed, because if he demanded a strategy, I'm sure they have one. They probably do have one. He just is not interested in learning it and getting involved with it.
Right. And I'm sure the Pentagon has all kinds of military contingencies. So if he said, give me a plan to do this, he would have it quite quickly, because the Pentagon has all kinds of contingency plans for a lot of different things. They've got people in the Pentagon, you know, constantly thinking of this and that and how to use the military. But I think it comes down to him, and I'm gonna speculate just quickly here, Barry, before we get to our topic. But I'm gonna speculate that I think what is really happening is that he knows he's gonna have to eventually fight ISIS. He knows we're gonna have to get to that battle at some point. And I think he also knows that once we cross that bridge, that we're gonna be fighting these guys. Maybe not as long as the second war that lasted almost 6 years. Certainly not as quickly as the first one that lasted a few months, but somewhere in between. And so that means that the last 2 years of his presidency are going to be consumed in a war that he never really wanted to fight, in a situation that he never really wanted to be in. So I think that explains to me a lot of his mental state, that he's like in a state of shock. He doesn't really understand why he is where he is, but he is where he is, Barry.
Yeah, it is what it is. And it reminds you of Lyndon Johnson. You know, at the end of his presidency, he was consumed by Vietnam, a war that he didn't create and didn't really want to be involved with initially, but ended up sending a massive amount of American forces there and then micromanaging it to near disaster. And it really derailed his domestic agenda, which was what he really wanted to do. And I think Obama's much like Johnson in that respect. He was not a foreign policy president. He thought his foreign policy consisted of nothing but going to Berlin or Cairo and making speeches. And if we just stopped meddling with the rest of the world would stop meddling in our affairs, and everybody would be happy. But that's kind of what Democrats and liberals, progressives have been saying for pretty much my lifetime.
Right.
That most problems of the world are caused by us. And he thought if he just pulled us out of the world, there would be no more problems. But instead, the problems are consuming his presidency.
That's right. And I just think he is, you know, he's really frustrated because this has not turned out to be the presidency that he thought it was going to be. But if you go back and look at presidents, it's never the way. I mean, if you look at the campaign, the presidency is never like the campaign. I'll just give you a couple of examples. In 2000. Iraq came up very little during the debates between Bush and Gore. I mean, very little. And yet, you know, a couple of years later, we were at war with Iraq, and that was probably the defining issue of President Bush's administration. You go back to 1940 with FDR running for another term, basically saying that we were not going to get into a war. Then you look at 1960, Vietnam never came up between Kennedy and Nixon, and yet Vietnam was the issue of the 60s. So just because you run for something and you run a campaign, it doesn't mean your presidency is going to be about that. In fact, usually the presidency is about something totally different, and you better be ready for it because it'll consume you, like you're saying, it consumed LBJ.
Well, I mean, that's precisely germane to what we're about to talk about. As we mentioned last week, Woodrow Wilson, American president during World War I, ran for re-election in 1916, and his whole campaign was based on the premise that he kept us out of war, that the war that had started in 1914 and raged for the first couple years without our participation did not draw the Americans in, and he took credit for that. And yet the following year, in fact, 3 months after he was inaugurated, we were at war with Germany.
Right.
So there's really no predicting these things, you know, never quite happen like you expect.
No, they don't. In fact, you can almost assume that the unexpected is going to happen, that if you're going to be president of the United States, that something that isn't on the table on the first day that you show up to work is going to be the issue. And I think it is amazing to me, ironic, that he would end up, having to deal with Iraq here in the last couple of years. Well, why don't we go to Woodrow Wilson? That's one of the topics tonight, is America entering World War I. So take it away. Take us into the events where we left off last week and into the United States entering the war.
Well, let me just recap for our audience. We have talked our way up to late 1917 and just about to start 1918 with American involvement. And what happened in World War I up to this point, to recap it in about one paragraph, is pretty much bloody stalemate. All the powers marched gaily off the war in 1914, expecting, as we've just said, something that didn't occur. They expected not what happened, but their expectations were that we'd have a short war pretty much over by Christmas. And armies entered battle on horseback and with bayonets and banners flying and colorful uniforms. And by this point in the war, by 1917, the troops are wearing dirty, tattered, muddy uniforms, living in rat-infested trenches on the Western Front. And we really entered the age of modern warfare. And we have airplanes flying overhead and dogfights. We'll talk about the aerial war next episode. We have mass bombing of cities by German zeppelins for the first time ever seen in warfare. We have submarine warfare, which has really crippled the British economy. About 500,000 tons a month were being lost in 1917 to unrestricted U-boat warfare by the Germans. And, of course, this is what will trigger the United States coming to the war, partially, will be the sinking of one of these ships by a U-boat in 1915 called the Lusitania. The British ship, the RMS Lusitania, was sunk, and 120-plus Americans were killed on board. And as 1917 begins, the Germans make a calculation. The Kaiser's calculation is that they can cripple Britain with submarines, and they very, very nearly do, very nearly cause starvation in Britain. The height of the submarine offensive in April sees nearly 900,000 tons of shipping go to the bottom of the Atlantic. However, the calculation is that America will come into the war because of that. This is what they realize, that Woodrow Wilson will bring us into war if we keep sinking ships. But they think they can knock Britain out of the war first. And, of course, this is a calculation that proves false. Instead, what happens is Britain starts using the convoy system, which will also come back in World War II, in which instead of ships sailing by themselves and being sitting ducks for torpedoing, they will go in large groups surrounded by destroyers, which will convoy them across the Atlantic. And these destroyers do a pretty good job of keeping the submarines from doing their job of sinking these ships, and so Britain survives. And America is increasingly angry. In fact, Teddy Roosevelt, the former president, called it piracy. He was outraged. And he, along with Leonard Wood, a Civil War general, really led the hawks in America, calling for a joining of the war. But the election of 1916, as we mentioned, comes along. Wilson campaigns on an anti-war strategy. And he wins re-election, but he is himself convinced that we have to go to war, that the events are too large, that America has to have a place at the bargaining table when the war is won, and that it's kind that we get involved. And finally, the trigger, as we mentioned last week, is something that the British intercept. And it's a telegram from Germany to Mexico. And that's the trigger that actually starts our involvement in the war. It's called the Zimmermann Telegram. It's from the German foreign minister to Mexico, Germany telling Mexico they will pay for Mexico's entry into the war against the United States. Germany will pay, finance, and arm Mexico. And there already were German officers advising the Mexican government at this point, and really had been, throughout that civil war that Mexico was just completing. Germany had a lot of capital in Mexico, a lot of political clout. And so Germany wanted Mexico to invade the United States from the south, and in return they'd get Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona as sort of booty, their war gain if they would. And this was the cause bellum that brought the United States into the war. And in April 6, 1917, the United States declares war on Germany, again, just months after Wilson wins re-election.
Now, let me ask you a question. Was public opinion... not really for the war. It took something like the sinking of a ship to at least get Americans to say, okay, let's get in. But there was a strong feeling in the United States back then, Barry, that this is none of our business. You know, a little bit of what we have now, actually, if you think about it. A lot of people saying, hey, you know, it's none of our business. Let's stay out of it. It's their problem. Let them figure it out. So I suppose there was a little bit of that, too, wasn't there?
There certainly was. And there was a strong anti-war sentiment in the United States, sort of a dovish faction. And Wilson won them over with a different argument. His argument to them was, this will be a war to end all wars.
Right.
And that became the famous slogan, that basically this was going to be a war against militarism, and that if the United States went in on the side of the, quote, good guys and defeated the mean and evil Kaiser, that the post-war structure would be such that we could create this new world order, which we'll talk about later with the League of Nations, that will prevent wars from happening in the future. And this is the argument he used successfully to bring the devs onto his side.
How ready was the United States militarily to enter this war? Because we hadn't fought a war in almost 20 years, the Spanish-American War, and that wasn't really much of a war, as you know. And then before that, we had gone almost 40 years without fighting a war. That was the Civil War. So how were we ready to get into a conflict like this, Barry?
Not at all. At the time the war was declared in April, beginning of April 1917, we had an army of 200,000 men, and 65,000 of those were National Guard. And the National Guard back then was not like it is today. It was not just a branch of the army ready to deploy when needed. It was, you know, it was really kind of a civil service sort of branch that was just there to help out with the disaster relief and flooding. And if we were invaded, then they could be, you know, mobilized. So we had a lot of work to do, and it took General Pershing, the commander of the American Expeditionary Force, the guy who just chased Pancho Villa into Mexico, along with his aide, Lieutenant Patton. We talked about that last week. George S. Patton, Jr., was actually a young officer at this time. It took him a year. It was a full year before American forces started to get into the war. By the time we actually finished our mobilization, we ramped up to about a 2 million-man army. We were sending over about 10,000 men a month over to Europe by summer of 1918.
But that's
so
pretty
quick.
We did
a fair bit of ramping up.
Yeah, that's pretty quick, wasn't it, to put together an army like that?
It really was, and they're called doughboys, if you remember the term.
Right.
The soldiers you sent over there with their brown uniforms and their, you know, British flat-brimmed helmets. And, you know, and their garters around their knee, up to their knees, from ankle to knee. They're called doughboys. And America, when America goes to war, when we're trying to get our mind wrapped around a conflict, as we did in this war eventually, and World War II later, we just go in wholeheartedly. Even the women's suffragette movement got behind the war and became sort of an auxiliary of the soldiers fighting.
Right.
And of course, the famous songs like "Over There" was a famous
right.
hit at the time, and there were parades. The soldiers marched down, you know, through Manhattan down the, you know, to the wharfs to be loaded in ships. But we really, when we finally did get into it, we went into it, you know, wholeheartedly. One of the things that Pershing insisted upon when he got there, we'll get to that in just a minute, the fighting of 1918, but one of the things he successfully argued for is that American forces had to fight as a unified force. The French generals and the British commanders wanted to use our troops as simply replacements for the losses they were taking and had been taking. In other words, American forces would go in there into their units and simply be commanded by British or French officers. And Pershing would have none of that. Americans fought as a whole, and we fought some magnificent actions, but we'll get to that in just a second. So that's what happened between 1917 and 1918. Other than that, the battles on the Western Front were bloody stalemates. We talked about the French army mutinied in 1917 for about a month to refuse to fight. So eventually, Marshal Pétain talked them into it and, you know, bullied them back into their service. But it was just a very despairing time for the Allies. They really thought at the beginning of 1917 they could win the war. There was a new commander named Neville on the French side that really charmed the British Prime Minister, Lloyd George. And he thought they could win with another all-out offensive, which again turned into bloody shambles. So really nothing was really done in 1970 successfully. So before we get any further into America, let's take a step back and we'll look at what's happening in Russia, because
I was going to tell you to go in that direction, but I just wanted one more question about the United States. At that moment, before World War One, where would the United States have ranked as a military power? Obviously, we were not the superpower, and we were pretty high, but where would we have ranked, in the top 10?
Probably, maybe the very bottom of the top 10, maybe somewhere between 10 and 15.
Okay.
I mean, certainly most of the European powers, the great powers, had larger militaries and more territory they controlled around the globe. The great powers being, of course, France, Britain, Austria, Russia, and Germany. Italy was a lesser power, though it probably had a greater standing army than the United States did. But we probably rated higher than, say, Greece or Bulgaria, but not much. And we probably didn't rate much more than Japan, which was just starting to come into fruition as the Japanese imperial power that it became in World War II.
So, I think what we had, Barry, was probably an economic machine that could produce tanks and weapons as fast as anybody. And we had a population that had not been depleted by war as some of the other countries. So those two things, you know, the manpower and the economic machine, were probably the two things that came into play, I would think. But one more quick thing about the United States. It really amazes me when you look at the timeline, how isolated from the world the United States had been really up to World War One. We just had never really been a player in the world scene. I guess maybe the distances had something to do with that, Barry.
That's exactly right. In the United States, from the time of the founding fathers, really tried to stay out of foreign entanglements, as the founders warned us. A bit of that changed in the Spanish-American War in the very end of the 19th century. Because we beat the Spanish, and we really, in the process of liberating Cuba and Puerto Rico from Spanish oppression, that was one of the main reasons we went to war. We also acquired an empire in the Pacific. We acquired Guam and Philippine Islands from Spain. And we had, for the next 10 years, we had our hands full trying to quell a mutiny or rebellion in the Philippines. First, the Catholic Filipinos in the north, and then later the Muslims in the south. So we were finally becoming a power that had to be aware of the world and make a place in the world. And if you remember Teddy Roosevelt, when he was president in the first decade of the 20th century, he launched the Great White Fleet, as it was called. We built a fleet of battleships, the pre-dreadnought-type battleship, and launched it across the Pacific and then across in the world tour. And these ships were all painted white, so they're called the Great White Fleet. And it was just a way of showing the world that we had arrived. And then during Teddy Roosevelt's presidency in, I think it was 1906, there was an incident in Morocco in which an American national was kidnapped by Moroccan Berbers, bandits, and the United States actually sent troops in there to rescue this hostage. Not the first time we would intervene in the Barbary states. So the United States was becoming a power, but we, under Wilson, we were less active than we had been under Roosevelt or Taft,
right.
Even.
Yeah.
So we were, but you hit it around there. We were a continental power. We spanned the entire continent,
right,
of North America. And we were primed and ready with our industrial base and our population to get involved in a big way.
Right, we were ready, but we just—I don't think a lot of Americans thought that this is how we would spend our economic power by going to war. Well, let's go to Russia. Fascinating topic. I've always been fascinated by the events in Russia at that time. By the way, there's a great movie. Anybody in the audience who wants to learn a little bit about Nicholas and Alexandria, there was a great movie called Nicholas and Alexandria. Back in the 70s, I guess. Great movie. I don't know if you recall seeing that, Barry. It was just a great movie about Russia, and it kind of gives you a quick lesson of what the last 4 or 5 years of Russia were before the communist takeover. But go right ahead. Tell us about Russia, because it's a fascinating component of the story.
Yes, well, throughout the war up until 1917, Russia had been fighting both the Austrians in the south in what is known as Galicia. It's basically north of the Carpathian Mountains and south of kind of southwest part of Ukraine and southern Poland. They'd been fighting against Russia, they'd been fighting against Austria, and they'd been fighting against the Germans a little bit further north in northern Poland and what was then known as East Prussia. And they'd taken terrible casualties, and they had not been handled very well. Of course, everybody was taking bad casualties during that war, but the Russians especially so. And they were badly led, badly equipped. They were not supplied properly. They had massive numbers, but their tactics were very rigid and unimaginative, and they took heavy casualties. And while this was going on, two main factors were at work. The first was underneath the surface, there was a simmering spirit of revolution, and it was partially Bolshevik, which is to say communist, which was a party that had been pushed underground by the Tsar's secret police that was still very strong and had a lot of ties among the workers in the factories. But there was also a non-communist component, the social democrats, and who wanted basically the Tsar to become a constitutional monarchy, much like Britain had. And in fact, the Tsar was, of course, not only the cousin of the King of England and practically his twin brother, as far as looks go, but he was married to Alexandra, who was a granddaughter of Queen Victoria. So there were a lot of British ties in Russia. And that's really what the Social Democrats wanted. They wanted a constitutional monarchy that would include the Tsar, but which would be run more or less by a prime minister and with the consent of the Duma, the parliament of Russia. And sadly for him and his family and the fate of Russia, the Tsar would have none of that. He would not give up power. And partially it was because his father had been murdered by anarchists after his father freed the serfs. His father had been the man who freed the slaves, essentially the peasants, made them free men, not tied to the land anymore. And he was a great reformer. And early in Nicholas's life, he watched his father be murdered by an anarchist, and he felt that the only thing his father had gotten for all he had done for Russia is to be killed. And the Russians couldn't really handle freedom, so he was much more authoritarian than his father was. So the war breaks out, and the Tsar's brother initially is in command, but eventually Grand Prince Michael proves completely incompetent, and the Tsar himself decides to leave the capital and go off to the front and command personally the armies, leaving the Tsarina, Alexandra, in charge. And this proves to be problematic. First of all, the Tsarina is terribly distracted by personal issues. Her son, the crown prince, Alexievich, is sick. He's got hemophilia. And even a simple fall, can cause him to bleed to death internally. And he has terrible pain caused by any small bruise. And she's a bit of a mystic. She's very superstitious. Not a very bright woman, sadly. And she eventually comes under the sway of a very dubious character who becomes infamous, a Russian priest and mystic by the name of Rasputin, Father Grigory Rasputin. And he wins her confidence as her confessor and as sort of a healer because he's able to heal the prince. No one knows how. Rasputin had some rather hard to explain powers, but one of them seemed to be he cured these painful episodes the prince had. But sadly, also for Russia, Rasputin was a debaucher of women. He was a man with a voracious sexual appetite, and he went around behind the scenes seducing and having these wild orgies with various princesses of the royal court, not the daughters of the Tsar, but women of the nobility. And in doing so, he brings the entire nobility of Russia, and particularly the royal family, into. And the communists, the Bolsheviks, are very, very quick and eager to pounce upon this. And throughout the war, there's all these pamphlets circulating throughout the cities of Russia, in which the Tsarina is considered, is portrayed as the mistress of Rasputin, and this evil monk is running the country behind the cuckolded Tsar's back. And this completely undermines the Tsar's credibility in the minds of the people. And by the way, this is a tactic the left has used other times and other places. If you go back to the French Revolution, they did the same exact thing before the revolution to Marie Antoinette, very unfairly, portraying her as an adulteress, which there's no evidence of that at all. So, you know, it's a common tactic to try to take the government and bring it into disrepute through these kind of salacious rumors. And sadly, Alexandra, in a relationship with Rasputin, just left herself wide open, you know, for that sort of thing.
So it did. She did have a relationship with him then, Rasputin and Alexandra, right? I don't want to get off on that angle of the story, but I had read rumors about this, and you know, I never thought they were true. But you believe they were?
No, I said we don't know.
We don't know. Okay, all right. Okay.
We don't know. We know he had lots of relationships with women of the court.
Right.
And he had a terrible power over the Tsarina, but we don't know if Alexandra actually committed adultery or not. Hard to say, but the rumors were enough to discredit the entire administration, if you will, the entire royal family. So eventually, in March of 1917, while the war is going very poorly, the various revolutionary elements stir up trouble in the capital, Petrograd or St. Petersburg, by shutting down the factories and creating a revolution. And the Navy, the fleet, which is stationed there in the Baltic fleet of Russia stationed there in St. Petersburg, goes over and joins the workers in basically revolting against the Tsar, which leads to the abdication of the Tsar and the forming of a new government, a provisional government, which includes the Bolsheviks. And by the way, let me back up just a bit, because the leader of the Bolsheviks was a famous character by the name of Vladimir Lenin, from which we get Leninism. And Lenin spent most of the war in exile, mostly in Switzerland. He'd been exiled years before by the Tsar's police, by the Tsar's authorities. But he'd been very much in touch with what was going on in his native country, as well as the rest of communism throughout Europe. And the way he got back to Russia is kind of interesting. The war was going badly for Germany in the sense they had not been able to knock out the French in the West in the first year, and they were tied down to a bloody struggle. And it became a two-front war. They did not want to fight with the Russian front and the Western front. And so in 1916, in an effort to break the stalemate, the Kaiser and his advisors came up with a plan to foment the revolution in Russia. They contacted Lenin in Switzerland and made a deal with him that he'd be transported across Germany in a sealed train, secretly, almost like he was a plague, you know, in a sealed vial. And they injected this, if you will, this political plague, this political virus into the body politic of Russia by returning Lenin to Russia. And in 1917, the revolution begins. And it starts off with the Social Democrats actually leading the revolution. But these Social Democrats, or Socialist Light, if you will, had to make a provisional government and ended up including the Bolsheviks, the communists. And by October, Lenin was in a position to start his own revolution called the October Revolution. And he overthrew the Kerensky government. Alexander Kerensky was the head of the provisional government. And by the way, he was still fighting the war, but he was trying to get out of it. During his time as president, the Bolsheviks were part of the government, but they weren't the prime minister by any means. They weren't the head of the government. Were secretly conspiring against Kerensky and undermining the army, fighting the war, by sending secret agents into the army and telling the soldiers not to obey their officers and basically stop fighting. And many did. Many deserted or shot their officers. This is all the behest of the Bolsheviks, who were supposed to be part of the government. So in October comes along, and Lenin overthrows the government and seizes power, and immediately begins negotiating the end of the war. And by December, the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk drops Russia out of the war. Russia leaves the war. And the Germans demand in return for armistice a pretty hard bargain. They annex all the western Ukraine as part of Germany, as well as southern Poland. So basically, German Empire now extends into what Hitler tried to achieve later, which is control of the breadbasket of Ukraine, you know, all the food and living space the Germans want. And that frees up the Germans to do what they need to do, which is to concentrate all those armies that are facing the Russians now in the West and try to finally bring them into war. And they know America's coming. America's declared war already, but they haven't got into it yet. So 1918 begins with Russia ending the war and getting out, and Germany massing for what they hope will be a final solution on the Western Front.
But the Russian conflict was really bloody too, wasn't it, Barry? I mean, the losses within Russia were unbelievable. Obviously, the weather was a big factor. You know, it gets pretty cold there. So, you know, you've got armies literally freezing to death. I don't know if you've seen some scenes from Dr. Zhivago, you know, but those soldiers had some pretty rough times out there in the Russian tundra.
Yeah, there's that great scene in Dr. Zhivago where you see soldiers literally frozen within their trenches, you know, frozen to death.
Right.
And then, of course, an officer gets shot, and you know, an old czarist aristocratic officer tries to command them to attack, and instead they just turn and shoot the guy. And that sort of thing happened. By the way, Russia took in that war about two, anywhere from the estimates range, in total casualties, somewhere between 1.7, 2.3 million dead. Now, as a percentage of the population, that was less than 2%, half what France and Germany took as a percentage of their population. The casualties were about the same. Germany actually lost about the same amount of men as Russia, but Germany is a much smaller country population-wise, and so as a percentage, it was closer to 4% of Germany's population. Just kind of an interesting fun fact we'll talk about more when we get to the end of the war.
Yeah. Go ahead and finish. I had another quick question, but go ahead and finish that thought.
I was just going to say, so that really wraps up 1917 and begins 1918. And go ahead and ask that question, then we'll move on.
No, I was just going to say, as the Russian Revolution was developing, were there many people back here in the West, in the United States or in Europe, who had a romantic view of communism, or did that happen later?
No, it was very prevalent then. And, in fact, if you watch that movie Reds with Warren Beatty and Diane Keaton, it's a story of an American who actually, the true story of an American, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but he's the only American to be buried in the Kremlin. But he was just one example of this romantic notion that people in the West had of communism, and many of them went to Russia to take part in this glorious experiment in communism. And this would continue clear through modern times until the fall of communism. There's a great book called Out of the Ice, and you'd have to look it up. I don't know the author's name, but it was this true story I read many years ago about a young man who spent his youth in Russia, in Gorky, because in the 1920s, because his father was part of a delegation of Americans that came from Detroit, where he was born and raised, to his father's native Russia. And Henry Ford, who had also sort of a romantic attachment to this notion, surprisingly enough, being the industrialist that he was, Henry Ford donated a Ford auto manufacturing plant to the Russians, to Lenin, and they built it in Gorky and manned it initially with American workers. There was an American colony in Gorky. And when Stalin came to power, he slowly, because of his paranoia, slowly came to weed out all the foreigners, and many of these Americans were sent to Siberia, including this author, who in his mid-20s was sent to a Siberian work camp for no other crime other than the fact that he was American. He spent the entire World War II, along with many other Americans, in this working camp out in one of the gulags of Siberia.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, now we're entering into 1918, which is, I believe, the last year of the war. But the world, I mean, the country fighting the war must have been very frustrated, the leadership of these countries, because the war was not advancing. Nothing good was happening. Casualties were very high. The war was not popular back home. It must have been a very frustrating time for the world as we finish 1917 and enter 1918, Barry.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, frustration and stalemate is the name of the game, at least in the West, you know, the Western powers. The only good news was that General Allenby would soon be capturing Jerusalem, which for Christians has great significance, obviously, but it had not been in Christian hands since the Crusades. And in January of 1918, the British begin an offensive that eventually will capture that year. By the end of the year, before the war ends, will capture all the Middle East, pretty much. And Allenby will have with him the help of the Arabs under Lawrence of Arabia. We talked about him last week. But that really is the only good, you know, good news on the Allied side, except they know the Americans are coming. And that's a little bit of bright news. But the Germans also know that. And 1918 begins with Erich von Ludendorff. He is a general along with Hindenburg, Paul von Hindenburg, who have become virtually the dictators of Germany. The Kaiser is advised, but basically all policy, all military policy is now run through the general staff, and that's run by the commander-in-chief, Hindenburg, and the chief of staff, Ludendorff. By the way, both those men will eventually become involved with Adolf Hitler. Ludendorff becomes a early Nazi in the 1920s, about the same time as that beer hall rebellion in Munich that ends up getting Hitler arrested and thrown in prison. And then Hindenburg, of course, is the president of Germany in 1932 that appoints Adolf Hitler as chancellor of Germany. So, but in World War I, Hitler is a corporal, and he's running messages on the Western Front from the rear up to the front, you know, running messages from the generals to the front lines. And Hindenburg and Ludendorff are the masters of Germany, and they plan to use all these troops that have now been freed by the collapse of Russia, whole armies, and reposition them by rail, by train, to the west. And the so-called Ludendorff Offensive is launched in early 1918, and it's nearly successful. It actually ends up stalling out just before Paris, but it makes great ground. Some 40 miles are captured, which in those days was a lot of territory. And the way that it worked was the Germans developed new tactics. They not only had more men now, but they improvised new tactics involving a formation of troops called stormtroopers or Stosstruppen. This is the name that Hitler will later give to his brown shirts, and it comes from World War I. And these were elite small groups of special operations forces, if you will. They're heavily equipped, and their job is to infiltrate Allied lines. Think of these trenches, and somehow infiltrate deep into the trench line before the offensive hits the trench line. Now, let me back up just a second and remind the listeners. Up until this point, tactics were really pretty stereotypical and unimaginative. Every time an offensive is launched, it usually involved hundreds of thousands of men, sometimes millions, charging across hundreds of miles of front line, and in mass, basically a bayonet fix, shoulder to shoulder practically, running across no man's land between the two trench lines, the German and the Allied. And these trench lines could be a quarter to a half a mile between barbed wire, sometimes even more. So this mile or quarter mile sprint across no man's land with absolutely no cover was disastrous and very bloody, with artillery raining down and machine guns mowing you down before you ever got to the barbed wire that covered the trench line. And if you ever got to the trench itself, the enemy is waiting for you with bayonets. And then hand-to-hand combat would ensue. So, and all these offenses, by the way, were preceded by days and days of artillery barrage, which really kind of gave it away. You knew it was coming because when the artillery stopped hitting you after 3 or 4 days, you knew that They're about to come over the top of their trench and attack you. And Ludendorff changed that. Instead of days of artillery barrage, there would be only a couple hours, and suddenly when the artillery would stop and shift, the stormtroopers would already be crawling through your trenches, and they'd be trying to make their way past your initial trench line to attack your command and communications centers in the rear, or take out key pillboxes that were supposed to support the front line, or attack your artillery in the rear. And then the masses of men would come over the top and charge once the stormtroopers have broken your line somewhere or weakened your defenses. It was very successful initially. Plus, the Germans had enormous cannons that could reach 25 miles mounted on railway lines, what they call rail guns, that actually could bombard from the German positions just about anywhere they wanted along the front, and eventually even bombard Paris. Paris was subjected for the first time to artillery barrage, and caused an enormous panic among the civilian population. So this Ludendorff offensive was initially very successful, but sadly for the Germans, in April, as it was getting underway, was just about the same time the Americans were arriving on the scene, and we were arriving en masse because, as I said before, Black Jack Pershing, John Pershing, wouldn't let us go in dribs and drabs. He wanted us to come in strength, and we were arriving in real force. And we arrived just in the nick of time. We got there just in time to plug the gaps and throw the Germans back as they were getting close to Paris. And it was really the American arrival there that saved France and turned the tide of battle.
Right. And as we're nearing the end of the show, there is an interesting when you said that we saved France a few days ago. We celebrated anniversary number 70 of the liberation of Paris in 1944. And once again, it was the United States that saved France in 1944. So it's interesting how these two wars are so similar. Not only are some of the people involved in the war the same people, Harry Truman as a soldier and Harry Truman as the president, you know, Patton and some of the others you mentioned last time. It's just remarkable how history repeats itself, isn't it, Barry?
Well, if it doesn't repeat itself, it certainly rhymes, as they say.
Right, right. Exactly.
Yeah, it sounds it's awful lot alike. There's one last thing I want to talk about before we conclude the show with the summer of 1918 beginning, and that was the Battle of Beersheba. And it's a fascinating battle, and I just want to cover it real quickly, and then we'll end the show. But it's Beersheba is located in just to the east of Gaza, and it's out in the desert, and it's south of Jerusalem. In early 1918, the British were stalemated between Gaza and Beersheba by the Turks and the Germans. The Germans were basically helping the Turks. They had helped the Turks form a defensive line called the Gaza Line. And it extended out into the desert south of Jerusalem, what's now called the Negev Desert. And the British had a real problem because there was no water and no way to get the troops water out in the desert. So the British were forced to stay close to the coast where they were confronted by these massive trench lines around Gaza. So it was much like the Western Front. So they couldn't go out to the desert without water, and the only water that would be waiting for them if they did was at Beersheba, the wells of Beersheba. And the Turks had gone to great lengths to mine the wells so they would be destroyed if the British came close to capturing them. So a normal offensive with ground troops would be too slow. And the position was well defended with infantry, Turkish infantry, supported by artillery and commanded by a German officer who really knew what he was doing and had all the wires, all the explosives, demolitions wired together. So with a single squeeze of a trigger, he could blow up the wells. And the problem was dealt with in an interesting fashion. The British were using cavalry to try to charge the position, because they're the ones who could get there fast enough to try to possibly overrun the well before the Turkish defenders could destroy it. But every time the cavalry would charge, they would get mowed down by Turkish machine guns and rifle fire. They were using these bolt-action German Mauser rifles. And, of course, artillery, which had all the positions staked out, so that, you know, when they got to a certain place, say 1,200 yards away from the trench line, the artillery would just start dropping right on top of them. So the British cavalry we're getting nowhere. And then the British brought up, after many, many months of this stalemate, brought up Australian Light Horse. And their job was simply to go up there and dismount from their horses. They were mounted infantry, because they weren't cavalry, they were mounted infantry from Australia. Their job was to get off their horses and shoot their rifles, and they were all pretty good sharpshooters, and try to pick off some Turks. And they'd done it several times, and the Turks got used to them. They knew these Australian Light Horse were not going to charge, that they were just going to skirmish. And so the Turks knew they'd do it at their maximum range, which is about 1,200 yards, because these rifles had great range. And so the Turks would set their sights on their rifles at 1,200 yards, and they set their artillery at 1,200 yards, and as soon as the Australians dismounted, they would begin shooting at them with artillery and rifle fire. Well, on one of these occasions, the Australians didn't stop and dismount. They charged, just like cavalry. And when they got at a walk, they were advancing first to walk, when they got to the 1,200-meter position, 1,200-yard position, and the Turks began opening fire, they then charged. And they soon were very quickly underneath that 1,200 range. They were closer. But the Turks were poorly trained troops, and they didn't reset their sights on their rifles, so they're shooting over their heads. Instead of continually reducing the range from 12 to 10 to 800 yards to 700 yards, they were still shooting at a target that should have been at 1,200 yards. The rifles were overshooting, and the artillery was also overshooting. Now, the Australians had nothing, no swords, no sabers to charge with. They had nothing but their bayonets that were supposed to be affixed to the rifles. They pulled those out and used those as swords. And they overran the Turkish lines so rapidly that the German officer didn't have a chance to pull the trigger and explode the well. And that's how the Australians captured Beersheba, which allowed the British then to advance onto Jerusalem and capture Jerusalem.
Interesting, interesting little story there at the end of our hour today. So next week we're going to be looking at 1918, and that is the last year of the war, but it's also it's a long year, isn't it, Barry?
It's a very long year, and the battles that America is involved with, which we still celebrate, the Battle of Chateau Thierry, Argonne Forest, all those will take place in 1918, summer of 1918, going right through October.
Right. And Harry Truman was a soldier in one of those battles, wasn't he?
As with George Patton and Douglas MacArthur as well.
Yeah, so that to me is the fascinating thing about this war, how, you know, you have soldiers who fought this war later would have prominent positions in the next war, which was about 25 years later. So it's just fascinating to me how men could be in both wars, obviously, different ranks, obviously. Soldier, Harry Truman was a sergeant, I believe. He was president in the Second War, but just an unlikely person to be president, too, Harry Truman. I don't think there were too many people in during the war who thought that this sergeant would become president someday. That's another interesting part about Truman and World War One, Barry.
Well, I think if you looked at Harry Truman in the middle of World War II, before he became vice president, you would think he'd be an unlikely man to ever become president.
That's right. That's exactly right.
He certainly was not Roosevelt's first choice as a running partner.
No, not at all. Not at all. He was one of those men who just happens to be at the right place at the right time, as they say. And if you read history, there's lots and lots of men like that who are in the right place at the right time. Well, Barry, that's going to do it for tonight. We've got Chapter 5 next week, and if we got to do a Chapter 6, we'll do it, because I'm finding this to be absolutely fascinating, completely fascinating. Yeah. And I thank you so much for joining me.
It is my pleasure, and, this is our fourth installment on the 100th anniversary of World War One, the war that shaped the modern world.
And we've got at least one more, maybe a couple more. We'll do however many it takes to do the topic justice, but I want to thank you so much, and thank you so much, and again, thanks to Leslie for sending in that suggestion. Leslie, thank you for sending that message, and good night to everybody. Good night, Barry.
Good night, Silvio, and good night to your audience.
All right, we'll talk to you later. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas. These are fascinating shows that we're doing with Barry. We've got a few more to go, at least a couple more. Well, one more for sure, maybe a couple more that we're going to be doing. Good night, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.